I don't know about some of you, but there are certain things as a part of a young man's education that you cannot receive in Sunday school, and your parents aren't going to tell you, and it's not going to happen at school. You need to hang out in an old-fashioned barber shop. And in old-fashioned barber shops, I can remember going to one regularly, not just to hang out, but to get my hair cut, my hairs cut, more than one. I would learn things in a barbershop. Not always polite things, certainly always irreverent things, because barbershops are places where sometimes the men who hang out there and the conversations that they have not been informed. They have not received the memorandum, for instance, about political correctness. If they did receive it, it was wadded up and thrown into a waste paper basket. But they are salty, and they talk about things that you need to know. Well, one barbershop that takes place in a story I love, on a Saturday evening, Troy Chatham was there waiting his turn at the barber's chair, and the men were talking about Vietnam. The subject got started, and I don't know and can't remember if they were talking about the Viet Cong or if they were talking about hippie protesters. But whichever one, didn't matter to Troy. Troy said this to all who would listen. "Looks to me like they ought to round up every one of them, every one of them sons of guns." This is barbershop talk, but I'm not going to repeat it all in a church setting. "They ought to round up every one of them sons of guns and put them right in front of the danged communists." Again, I'm not going to repeat his language exactly. "And then whoever killed who, it would all be for the good." Troy was advocating that the rabble-rousers would get put together with the communists and just let them have at it. Well, there was a pause, and after that, nobody wanted to top it. It was hard to do, but the barber, Jabers, quit cutting hair for a minute, screwed up his courage, and he looked directly at Troy, and he said, "Love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you." And Troy jerked, and his eyes widened, and he looked right at Jaber, and he said, "Where did you get that bunk?" Again, barbershop talk. "Where'd you get that bunk?" And I said, "Jesus Christ." And Troy said, "Oh." And then this commentary. "It would have been one of the great moments in the history of Christianity, except that I did not love Troy. It would have been a fantastic moment. I trumped his contempt. I spoke into the middle of his animosity, into the middle of his judgment for all that he found convoluting and convoluted. I spoke Jesus' words right into it, but the problem was I used Jesus' words just as contemptuously as he had been doing it. I didn't love him." And anybody who's honest with themselves and has been listening to these sermons we've been doing, and the sermon that Hutch did just last week about not judging others, about removing telephone poles out of your eyes so that then you can see to get the specks out of your neighbor's eye, who's listened to us as we talk about the Sermon on the Mount and God saying, "I want my people, this blueprint of humanity that I'm laying out before you, to replicate the Father's character in loving communists and loving ingrates and sexual deviants, people who don't know their right hand from their left. I want you to be like God and be kind to people who aren't going to be kind back. And aspire to the good of those who run roughshod right over you." Anybody who hears those words and looks at their life, honestly, maybe you need a little antiseptic of grace to be able to do that. Because it's hard, as T.S. Eliot said, for us to bear very much reality. But if you start to be able to see yourself as you are, you start to think, how on earth am I going to love my neighbor as myself? How am I going to insert an I for thou whenever I'm thinking about what should be done for the people around me? How would I want to be treated? How am I going to do for those downstream as I wish those upstream would do for me, as Wendell Berry once said? And Jesus gives us a very simple, but not simplistic, answer in these verses that Lisa just read to you. And it can be summed up with three letters: ask. 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 Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and the door will be open to you. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks, the door will be answered. Jesus says, ask. How are you going to be outfitted for the bone-chilling water in your whitewater ride of trying to love your neighbor as yourself? You're outfitted by asking. Paul Miller, in his excellent book on prayer, says that you can sum up all of Jesus' teaching in the Gospels by this concept of asking. All his teaching about prayer boils down to making requests of God. He's fairly irresponsible in the qualifications and caveats he offers. He says things like, if you remain in me and my words remain in you, ask whatever you wish, and my Father will do it for you. It is to my Father's glory that you bear much fruit, showing yourself to be my disciples. Ask, he says. Keep on asking. Ask about everything. Asking is the rule of the kingdom. Charles Spurgeon, that some of you may have heard of, sometimes called the Prince of Preachers, has a great sermon where he says, whether you like it or not, asking is the rule of the kingdom. If our elder brother Jesus, who has welcomed us into the family of God, if he himself is subject and not excused from this rule of asking, then neither will we be. And the Father says to him, ask of me, son, and I will make the nations your inheritance. Elijah will get his rain, and the nation of Israel will be blessed in their drought, but first Elijah must ask for it. And Samuel will bring blessing to the people of God, even though they've asked for a king and upset him. But first, he must ask for God's mercy. And Daniel will find Gabriel the angel coming. The moment he starts to pray and humble himself, we'll find mercy for the people in captivity. But first, he must ask. And the Apostle Paul and Solomon, they will be used. Wisdom will be given, conversions will be had, churches will be planted, but first they must ask. Asking is the rule of the kingdom. And so Jesus says the same thing. How are you going to not judge people? How are you going to live replicating God's character in your work and in your families and in your neighborhoods? How on earth are you going to be good to people who are not good to you first? How on earth are you going to overcome resentments that have you sitting up late at night thinking of how you might get somebody back? That keep you locked in and chained to those who have wronged you? How are you going to get free from that? Jesus would say one huge part of it is asking. Ask. Ask. Over and over again. Dallas Willard says the reason we start to look at this is the power of asking is the way that humans interact with one another. And if you don't realize the power of the simple ask, the power of request, let me give you an example that he gives, a negative example of just how powerful requests are in the human realm, people to people. Imagine you go downtown on a dreary Monday morning. You're getting out of your car. You're going to go get some coffee at Greyfriars or whatever it is now called. Is that what it still is? And you get out of your car. You're fumbling about to try to find your wallet to get a parking pass, and there's a dude across the street, He's scanning eyes, waiting for a pair to lock with his. Or maybe it's a dudette. But you've known this experience, because as soon as they catch somebody's eyes, there's this lock, and they start coming over to you, and they're going to ask you for money because they need a new serpentine belt, or they need to get bus fare to go to Alabama, or they need breakfast, or they just need you to spare a dime. And some of them are extra honest and just want some beer, and they'll tell you. That will warrant my sympathy most. But why will you do so much to avoid locking eyes with that person? Why will you do so much to walk away quickly? It's amazing experiment in social psychology to watch people try to get away from people who are about to ask them for things. It's because when people ask you for things, it's powerful. It's very powerful. It's very hard to say no. Even if you feel justified in saying no, you feel ill at ease. You feel wrong doing it. Because when someone needs something and they ask you specifically to address that need, it evokes a power over you. And that's just a stranger. That's a panhandler. Think about it in your own house. Half the things you parents do, it's because your kids wore you down. They eroded your will and your thoughts and your energy because they just could ask faster and more persistently and more imaginatively than you could ever think to ward it off. They just asked. There's power in asking, and Jesus says, that's what you apply to God. People who raise money will find this out. We have a lot of money raisers here, development people. The difference between someone who does it well and someone who does it poorly generally can boil down to this. Are you willing to look somebody in the face and say, would you like to give a gift? I'm asking you. I'm asking you to give a gift for $1,000, for $50,000, for $100,000, for $10. People who just send out random letters and they never ask, people don't respond. You got to ask. I think that's a great secret of the development world. You just have to ask specifically. But because this power of asking is so supreme and God invites us to it, he does realize. He's letting you in on a inner room where the world is governed. And he knows he can't just say yes to everything. If he does indeed say yes to every single thing that you ask, it might be dangerous for you because the power of asking is so great. It's a power that most of us don't have the character or the equipment to fully engage with. It reminds me of Dave and Sally Wallander here this morning. One of our elders, Dave and Sally, and I've thought about this often as a parent. They'd say this about their kids. Generally, if their kids would ask them for something when they were growing up, and all their kids are out of the house now, oh, there's some kids are here though. I'm going to tell some stories. No, this isn't bad, but when the kids would ask for something, Dave said our stock answer was, we're going to have to think about it. And when they would say, no, we need to know right now. And Dave would say, well, here was our answer. If you need to know right now, the answer is no. That's free parenting advice. Because if you're a parent, haven't you ever sometimes just thought, why was this not in the manual? That they are going to invent things to ask for, and they're going to come at me like a snowstorm, flakes coming at me, meteors, and I'm going to have to dodge. I cannot even outthink these people who are just inventing things to ask for, things that they want to do, things that they need to go see, things that they want to have. And sometimes you just want to say, no more asking, because they don't have any sense of, I'm too dignified to ask about this. They just know they need something, and you're the one who's going to give it, and so they're going to wear you down. And sometimes God, recognizing the power of asking, it's because some of you stop asking because he hasn't done something right. Sometimes he says, wait. You got to wait. This is a powerful thing. You don't even know what you're asking for. And often, wise people will tell you, Paul Miller has mentioned this, and you've discovered it in your own life, some of you. If you've asked and sought and knocked about a thing, about an obstacle, about some major issue in your life, and God hasn't yielded yet, very often it's the case that the very process of asking, the very process of seeking, the very process of waiting is in itself a way that God is forming you and to someone who can love others, who can forgive others, who can trust, who can open himself up to not have to have his own way, who can be released from the tyranny of their own desires and their own wishes about making the planet like they want it. Sometimes God says no, sometimes he says wait, because the power of asking is so supreme that if you got everything you asked for, it wouldn't be good for anybody. Ask, Jesus says. But when you start to realize that this is the rule of the kingdom, and it's in a very powerful invitation, even though it's a very simple concept, you'll start to realize there's not really anything I can't ask God about. Some of you don't have much of a prayer life because, well, it's maybe because you're disillusioned. Some of it's because you just kind of think, I don't want to bother God with insignificant things, I can handle it. Rosemarie Miller, who's the wife of Jack Miller, they started World Harvest Mission, Jack Miller, and she started lots of churches together. They did mission work in slums in Uganda and missions in Ireland, and radical evangelist, constantly praying for the move of Christ. One time they were in London with their granddaughters, and a granddaughter said, "Hey, Mom, this author on prayer says that it's selfish to ask God for parking spaces." And Rosemarie Miller, this giant in the faith, this person deeply dependent on the risen Christ, said, "How else would you find a parking space?" Because someone who has realized that God is superintending all affairs and realizes it's not like a zero-sum game, like God's running low on cash, like the economy has somehow pinched his resources, his capital has to stay where it is, and so there's no more giving this year. No! God has limitless reserves and inexhaustible resources, and so he says, ask! Wear him down with asking. Ask about anything and everything. What do you need God to do in your life? Invite him to do it. Do you need a parking space? What a gift it is for some of you. You got four kids in the car. They're throwing Cheerios at each other. You're wanting a drink and you know you shouldn't. Just kidding. Am I kidding? To find a parking space, wouldn't that be the most magnificent gift of God on a rainy day like this if he'd find you a spot up near? Just last week, I found myself praying for Goldie Hawn. Goldie Hawn is the name of Virginia Baird's bird. Not Kate Hudson's mom, and that's her name also, but Goldie Hawn is a bright and colorful bird that Virginia loved very much, and Judy Dutton and I, after Virginia went to the hospital, we had to go over to her house. I offered to go with her because Judy was going to get the bird, and we were going to take it to Dr. Keller's office, and just the day before, Judy had been, well, a living perch for Goldie Hawn. Goldie Hawn had landed on her head and started pecking her head. And I thought, I can't send this woman over there to get this bird by herself. I said, "You want me to go with you? We'll get the bird." And as we started to get this bird, something I've never yet done, and no one in any class in pastoral theology ever talked about this in seminary, I said, "Judy," and I felt about as silly as a man can feel, "I think we had better pray. Because I don't know how, this bird was just loose in the house. I don't know how we're going to get this bird into this cage. I think we had better pray." This bird had just been on her head the day before. And I prayed to the Lord who loved Virginia and who loved Goldie Hawn and who made her. And that bird cooperated with me and went into a cage. And then I rode shotgun with Goldie Hawn to the vet. It's the only time I've ever ridden shotgun with Goldie Hawn. You start to realize that God means it when he says ask, then you're going to ask him for big things. So you're going to ask him for everything. And it's really a self-validating kind of thing. Start praying a lot and you're going to see a lot of prayers answered. And some of you don't pray because you're conspiracy theorists. You think God might be up to something nefarious. You think he might not be so good. You're not sure if his intentions for you are right. You know, Kathy and I are about to have celebrated 25 years, I think, this year in fall. Sorry. 25 years of being dating and or married. And one time we went to the beach. I went to the beach with our family when we were in college. And at the end of this beach trip, it was time to eat supper. I mean, breakfast. It's always supper time for me. And I had grown up in a family where you drank 2% milk, and I drank voluminous amounts of it. Well, in her family, they drank skim milk, and I always thought skim milk looked like whole milk, 1 inch of whole milk at the bottom that you put water in the rest of. It didn't look like it ought to. But I was also a dutiful person and didn't want to let anybody down, so I poured my cereal that last day, and I put the skim milk on there, and I started eating it and choking it back. And Kathy also made some cereal, and she took a bite and went, "Oh gosh, that milk is sour." And my conclusion was, "Oh, I just thought that's what skim milk tasted like." I was dutifully choking that stuff down as I had done squash earlier in a meal with her parents. And sometimes you think you're going to ask for milk, God's going to give you sour milk that looks like it. And Jesus says, no. Look at your own aspirations for your own kids. Grandparents, your own aspirations for your grandkids. Those of you who have been parented well, the kinds of kindnesses, the largesse, the benefaction that your parents showed to you, and realize that that is all derivative. Jesus says in a very unflattering way, you guys are twisted, you're demented, you're evil. And yet, as parents, you're awfully good to your kids. When they need something, you're not going to trick them. Which of you, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for fish, will give him a snake? If you then, though you're evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more your Father will give good gifts to those who ask him? He doesn't want you to think of him suspiciously. He wants you to think of him as someone who's actually eager to do good things for you. Haven't you felt that as parents? Just an eagerness to do good to your children? To bless them? To make them smile? Where do you think you got that? The one who made you. And whatever you've got of it, he's got way more. And he says, would you think of him that way? Askings get answered. As we look into this beginning of our 14th year as a church, and I look over the last 13 years, I am amazed at how many things where I can say the Lord answered our askings. We've helped churches plant. We're hoping to plant one ourselves next summer, maybe. We've started Lula Lake Church. We've helped with church plants in Portland and Rome, Georgia, in Central Asia and India, because we ask and God answered. I'm fat and alive today instead of skinny and dead because God answered our askings. There are people in our church who should have left because they were so alienated, they were so hurt, they were so aggrieved in some way, and they didn't because God answered our askings. We've seen anxious people, addicted people released, depressed people revived. We've seen orphans find homes because God answered our askings. Troy and Sarah are in Uganda right now getting Ezra Derek, bringing him home, another child, into a parent in the community of faith. We've seen businesses flourish, employment given, marriages renovated because God has answered our askings. We've got two buildings, renovations and additions paid for because God has answered our askings. So I'd ask you, as we enter into this 14th year, what about your life is not like it should be? What deficits are you aware of? What things aggravate you? Well, will you wear God out with your asking, the God who's eager to hear from you? What is it about this church that makes you grumble? The inefficiencies, the defects, the things about it. I know more things wrong with this church than you do, but you got issues with us. Come on, I know. Would you ask God for us? You might be depriving your business. You might be depriving your employees, your coworkers, your community because you're failing to trust God's generous invitation to ask and to seek and to knock. There might be untold littering of God's loveliness all around you because you're not asking yet. Wear God out with your asking. Be imaginative in your asking. Ask often and frequently and see if he means what he says. That's the way you get to be able to love others. You start to realize I'm someone that's wholly dependent on God to be gracious to me every second of the day. And everybody who agitates me is too. Anybody I might be tempted to think I'm better than, anybody who might not be doing for me what I think they ought to be, they're the same kind of person as me who stands every second in need of God to do something to rectify a very crooked situation. We are, as Alden said, crooked little-hearted people called to love our crooked little neighbors. And I want to close with this as I ask you to ask for our church. I saw a video this week, one of those videos that at first I laughed about, and then I didn't know, kind of like an episode of The Office, whether I should laugh or be crying, because I watched a pastor self-destruct on tape, and now millions of people have seen it as well. This pastor was preaching, and someone started to fall asleep. Well, this has happened to me before. But what I have not done before when that happened, I have thought to myself, you didn't even give me a chance. I've seen people fall asleep before I even started talking. It's like, you're not even trying. Come on. I said this inside. My internal dialogue is frequent and active. But this guy actually went down to the congregation. And he said, I am somebody. I'm important. You might fall asleep on your English teacher. You ain't going to fall asleep on me. I'm teaching you about eternal things. And he shakes the boy. Come on, stand up. You know I love you, don't you? He says that. You know I love you after I've just shamed you into waking up. And you're never going to sleep again. And that pastor, something was not right. He was having a bad life, I think. Said, well, you say he's not going to come back. Well, he's not here in the first place. And as he starts to walk, he looks and sees, I'm not pointing at anybody in particular. You think I'm pointing at you, I'm not. He looks over and says, and you, I notice on the calendar I'm supposed to marry you. What makes you think I'd marry you? Why, you're one of the sorriest church members I got. You ain't worth 15 cents. And you, what makes you think I'd marry you to him and him to you? When you don't know where on the earth you're supposed to be. And then he walks over to the guy and says, come here, big fella, stand up. You know I love you, don't you? Yeah, just a tip. Don't tell somebody they're the sorriest church member you got and then tell them you love them. It might seem strained. Well, from there on, it just got worse. Self-destruction. And any of you who've known your own heart can realize there are times in your life where you could do that to people. Be filled with criticism, be filled with this sense that everybody's against you and you're ashamed and you're discouraged and you just want to lash out. You just want to pew, 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 pew. You just want to let people have it. But in the same vein, as we think about loving others as we want to be loved, and as we think about what God is urging, this asking because of his goodness, his eagerness to bless, his fondness for his children, it reminds me as well of an article I read where the two coaches over 30 years did informal surveys of college athletes, and they asked them, what was your most horrible part? What was the worst part about growing up playing ball? And to a T, almost all of them said this, the ride home with my parents. That was the worst part. The ride home. The little comments, even if they weren't overbearing. Why'd you swing at that high outside pitch? At that piano recital, did you just get confused on that note? You did well. You just stumbled at that one place, I noticed. How come you didn't throw it home? And when I asked, what was your favorite part about playing sports? And they said, it's when my parents said, I love to watch you play. They said, that's why grandparents... You see, grandparents are over it. And so they come and they watch their kids, and all they do is they just think their grandkids are wonderful. And grandparents are the embodiments of grace to little kids. They don't require anything of them. They just lavish them with things. And it said these athletes loved having their grandparents around. They loved it when people, their parents or grandparents said, I love to watch you play. And as you think about the goodness of God and this request of asking, how many things we've seen answered, I want to tell you in the beginning of our 14th year, the beginning of my 13th year here, after 12 years of being with you, I love to watch you guys play. I love it that James and Lizzie Ott at the Lulu Lake Church are servants extraordinaire. Lizzie's caring for some of your children here, and James is running Volunteers for America in Trenton, where intellectually disabled people are being able to live independently, and he's helping them. And Caleb Howard and Amy Dykstra of Rock Creek are also down there working to help these people do it, and I love to watch them play. I love to watch you business people, whether you're in banking or insurance, whether you're a small business owner or a contractor, fussing over your employees, caring about how you're representing the Lord and the way you carry out your business, doing your work well and wonderfully. I love to watch you play. I love it when I think about how many teachers God has given us. Marilyn at CSAS and Nikki at East Lake and Jameson at East Hamilton and Pat at CCS and Brennan at Fairland, Beth at Bright, Aaron at LMS, Lisa will start at Ivy Academy, Catherine, the Girls Leadership Academy, Amy Ball and Orchard Knob, all over the city. I know I've left somebody out. Matt Jelly with the collar. How can I leave him out? Dade County. I love to watch you play all over the city. Children have been entrusted to your care. And you care for them and you love them and you pour your lives out to them. And I love to watch you play. I love it that there are children in this church who are chomping at the bit to have a lemonade stand, and the parents say, you can have a lemonade stand, but the proceeds got to go to orphans. And that somehow or another, in a feat of the most expensive lemonade and cookies ever, that lemonade stand makes a couple hundred bucks on Mount Olive Road. I love to watch you play. Kyle and Shannon Taylor are holding the foster baby back there, and Troy and Sarah, and so many of you have adopted, and so many of you have adopted many years ago, and I love to watch you play. Harry Abel started home teams to care for widows and their lawns, and I love to watch you play. On Friday mornings, I pray with a group of guys, Hutch and I. They're part of the generation that I keep reading all these articles about. It's the worst generation. It's a worthless generation. You millennials, you're worthless. Do you know this? Do you see I'm being facetious? But that's what all the literature is in agreement about. Millennials are worthless. They don't care about anything. They don't care about institutions. They don't work hard. They're self-entitled, blah, 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 blah. But you know what I see with these four guys that we pray together with? I see them confessing their sins and praying for the life of Christ in our church on Friday mornings. I see them praying for this community to see God move in it more and more. And I love to watch them play. I love to watch the way you care for widows and orphans and the poor around you. That a fellow eager to make an anonymous gift, and me saying, thank you so much for this, a gift that was going to underwrite a mercy effort we were doing. And I said, I know the Lord will repay you either now or later. And he said, I don't care about that. It's just so exciting to me to be a part of this, and I love to watch you play. Just this week, two people contacted us because they're trying to help people in dangerous situations, messy situations. They're moving into darkness and chaos for Jesus' sake. And I love to watch you play. And it reminds me of Gerard Manley Hopkins' poem, As Kingfishers Catch Fire. And part of it, he says, the just man justices, keeps grace that keeps all his goings graces. Acts in God's eyes what in God's eyes he is, Christ. For Christ plays in 10,000 places, lovely in limbs and lovely in eyes not his, to the Father through the features of men's faces. It's a poem that recognizes that you are united to Christ and he's brokering his life through you in 10,000 ways. Mothers thanklessly pouring their lives into little urchins who will just take and take and take and take, and you keep doing it, and they're learning to trust God. Fathers who keep enduring incredible responsibilities, all of you who give and serve and forget yourself, lovely in limbs and lovely in eyes, to God you look like Christ in the world. This is the kind of God you serve, who says to you, as I'm saying to you, I love to watch you play because I'm on your side, because I'm working through you. And even when you think you're not doing something, I'm working through you. And to me, you are as Christ. You believe in him like that, you'll keep asking, Lord, what shall we do this week? Lord, whom shall we help? How shall my business represent Christ? How shall my family? How shall we as a church bless other communities? How shall we be generous in giving ourselves up? Lovely in limbs and lovely in eyes, not his, to the Father, to the features of men's faces. God loves to watch you play. Let's pray. Father, we're glad we stand here with someone who is inexplicably on our side. Help us to believe it. And as we come to confess our sins before you, help us to trust that this is something we do to clear the air and something we can do because you're on our side and you love to watch us play. Would you hear us as we recite together the prayer in the first panel of our bulletin? We do not presume to come to this your table, O merciful Lord, trusting in our own righteousness, but in your manifold and great mercies. We are not worthy so much as to gather up the crumbs under your table, but you are the same Lord whose property is always to have mercy. Grant us, therefore, gracious Lord, so to eat the flesh of your dear Son, Jesus Christ, and to drink his blood, that our sinful bodies may be made clean by his body, and our souls washed through his most precious blood, that we may evermore dwell in him, and he in us. Amen.